This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotagen, and today we'll be discussing how Twitter finally called out Donald Trump's dangerous tweets, the violence caused by WhatsApp disinformation campaigns in India, and social media bot accounts that become human. For all this, I'm joined by John Nicholson MP for Ochil and South Perthshire, and Scottish National Party spokesperson in the House of Commons for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. He is also a member of the DCMS Select Committee. Alongside John is Shakuntala Banerjee, who is Professor of Media, Culture and Social Change in the Department of Media at the London School of Economics. We'll also be hearing, as always, from our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. John Nicholson, it's great to have you on the Infotagen podcast, having been obviously on the Select Committee with you in the past and on your radio programme. It's great to have a chance to have a further chat on here.
I know that you're
a keen observer of President Trump and his social media habits, and have raised these in the past, and indeed we've discussed them on your radio show in the past. I'd be interested in what you make of the events of the last few days, and in particular the great issues around Twitter marking up Donald Trump's tweets as being unreliable.
What extraordinary times we live in, Damien. Who would have thought that we would live in a world where the President of the United States has to have his words removed because he's glorifying and encouraging violence? It's an absolutely extraordinary development. And of course, like Twitter are quite right. You and I have locked horns with Twitter and other social media platforms in the past, and they've been far too slow, Twitter, in tackling violent messages, messages that carry disinformation about the coronavirus, apart from anything else, and those that involve online bullying. And I'm therefore happy to see, at long last, Twitter show some initiative and courage. They've already done this with Bolsonaro, the president, the gruesome president of Brazil, who's a coronavirus denier. And now they've done this with President Trump. Not before time, I say.
Absolutely. I completely agree. It's quite interesting as well that Donald Trump has responded by opening this debate. It's an issue we've talked about before and we've talked about on the podcast before, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is the piece of legislation which makes platforms neutral, so they don't have legal liability for bad stuff on those platforms. Now, in the past, we've called for that to be reformed as a way of making the platforms more responsible. It seems that Donald Trump is now using this as a way of making sure that people can say whatever they like on Twitter and Facebook without any redress by the platform against them, which seems a kind of event.
You've got to laugh as well, haven't you? But Donald Trump talks about freedom of speech. Of course, he is a product of the whole poisonous culture of shock jock radio, isn't he? And its overspill into television and then into social media. I mean, in the old days in the United States, when I lived in the United States when I was a student there, but broadcasters used to have a duty of care that they were seen to be objective in the same way that they are here in the United Kingdom with Ofcom. And then, of course, under Reagan Bush, that was undermined. It was removed. It doesn't seem clear that they really understood the consequences of what they were doing. And that allowed this dreadful rise of Fox News and the right-wing radio hosts, which led in turn to Trump's election. So it's interesting to see Trump flag up free speech in this way, because to allow anybody to say anything, whatever they like, all the time isn't really free speech. America's long had a tradition that it respects free speech, but puts controls on what the Americans call fighting talk. So in other words, you're allowed to say, I don't like homosexuals. But what you're not allowed to say is, I think homosexuals should be shot dead. That crosses a line into fighting talk. And that, of course, is the line that Trump has crossed and that Twitter belatedly has decided to resist.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I watched last year, Mark Zuckerberg gave a
a lecture at Georgetown University in Washington. And he made actually a very similar point to the one you're making, which is that the First Amendment constitutional rights of Americans to free speech, you know, have long been upheld and are very important indeed. But there's always been a tension between people's freedom of speech and the harm that speech can cause others. So, I mean, are you surprised that Facebook are not going to follow Twitter's path in acting against harmful speech from politicians?
I'm not surprised in the slightest. Again, you and I on the select committee on which we both sat and on my radio show and elsewhere have always agreed about this, haven't we? That Facebook has been utterly appalling in this. And the thing about Facebook, and I think people who don't necessarily follow this that closely, Facebook always calls itself a platform. In other words, it says it's not really expressing a view. It's just giving a platform to people to express their own views. But Facebook isn't a platform. Facebook is a publisher. And with its status as a publisher should come responsibility that you do not allow people to say whatever they like under all circumstances. Mm. You don't allow people to call for violence. You don't allow people to communicate complete misinformation at a time of a global pandemic, for instance. You don't allow people to say that it's okay to drink bleach and that bleach will cure your coronavirus. You don't allow people to say that without, at the very least, having some sort of explanatory note that says this is entirely untrue and wrong. And of course, it has direct consequences. We see that in Brazil, where people have listened to Bolsonaro, and it now has the largest infection rate in the whole of South America. We saw it even in the aftermath of the bleach comment by Donald Trump. There were people in the United States who were subsequently ingesting bleach as a result of this. It was reported with the exact details in the Hill newspaper. So the words that senior politicians use have repercussions and consequences, and thus the onus on Facebook and Twitter to monitor what they say and to offer some sort of counter-narrative is absolutely vital.
Absolutely. And there's one final thing I want to ask you about is there's a thread that runs through all this as well, which I find increasingly alarming, which is the constant attacks on what are called mainstream media. And you see this on social media now, just reduced to MSM. I can't think of a time when journalism and journalists have been under such constant attack in that way from politicians like Donald Trump and as a kind of currency of abuse through social media. And I mean, I know you're a journalist, so I expect you to stand up for your trade, but you know, the voice of journalism has always been important in holding power to account. And for it to be abused in this way, I find very concerning.
Absolutely. What Donald Trump wants is ongoing chaos, where words don't really count for anything and where truth is immaterial. So if you disparage the MSM constantly and you give equal credence to CNN and to conspiracy theorists online, then you undermine the whole basis of expertise. And as lay people, we think it's important to listen to experts when we're in a global pandemic. We expect at times of elections for our journalists to try and report objective truth. And we're not immune to that in this country as well. I mean, we've seen a particularly shocking example in the last 72 hours at the BBC, where Emily Maitlis, the presenter of BBC Newsnight, begins her programme with a statement of fact that Dominic Cummings had broken the rules. We know that to be the case because we know what he did and we know what the rules are. And no amount of gaslighting by the government will persuade us otherwise. And we also know that the Durham police have now said that he broke the rules. So what Emily Maitlis said was absolutely accurate. I have no idea what Emily Maitlis votes or what her private views are on anything. I don't expect to know what her private views are, but I expect her to be a fearless journalist. And for the BBC to succumb to pressure in the way it has done over Emily Maitlis and Dominic Cummings, and to apologise on her behalf, I think is absolutely shocking. Isn't it disturbing that in the aftermath of the Dominic Cummings affair and his egregious behaviour in breaking the rules in the way that he did and the absurd excuses given for it, isn't it shocking that the only person who's been punished for this is a neutral journalist, and that by the very employers at the BBC who should have been defending her?
And I think a narrative that's gone along with it as well, that in some ways this whole affair is the fault of the media, rather than being a matter of genuine inquiry that people are genuinely interested and quite angry about.
Noticeable that Michael Gove, the person who derided experts in the Brexit referendum, is now popping up on television and laughing in a way that seems almost mocking. And I have a lot of time for Michael Gove, and I've known him for a long time. But, you know, when he was asked the direct question about whether he had ever gone on a drive to test his eyesight, the answer, of course, to that should have been no, it's an absurd thing to do. But instead of that, he said, yes, he had also, like Dominic Cummings, tested his faulty eyesight by going for a drive. And then he started laughing. It's not a time for laughter with people dying all across the country.
Now, I'd like to bring in Shakuntala Banerjee, who's a guest today. And we've been talking about sort of bad content on social media and places where you can see it and other people can see it, particularly on Twitter and Facebook. But I think that we've always acknowledged that one of the hardest areas to understand the power of the viral spread of information and the damage it can do and the real world harm it can cause is on encrypted messaging services like WhatsApp. And we're delighted to have the chance to discuss that with you today, and in particular, the work that you've done studying the use of WhatsApp in politics in India, where it is a major part of how people share information. And I'd be interested to hear about that, but also your views on the use of WhatsApp in as a tool to spread disinformation around coronavirus as well. Because I know, looking at Infotainment, we've had seen plenty of examples of WhatsApp being one of the main ways in which disinformation is being spread.
Thank you, Damien. There's plenty of synergies and connections between what was being said about the US and Brazil and India. And there's also a slightly divergent history. So let me just tell you about the research that we were doing quite a while before coronavirus hit. And that I will use as a way of segueing into the coronavirus misinformation that we're looking at now. So India has, since 2014, had a far right-wing government with a very, very strong tendency towards Hindu chauvinism, which is known in India as Hindutva. The government have used a variety of trolling and WhatsApp and other groups to spread a message both against their political opponents, or whether those happen to be on the liberal left or center, but also against large swathes of the Indian population. So the large Muslim communities, for instance, certain language groups in the Northeast have been targeted very, very strongly on WhatsApp. Now, 2 years ago, we applied for and got a WhatsApp misinformation grant at my institution, and we had planned, at least when we started to do this, to look at the connections between the kinds of users who were passing on misinformation on WhatsApp and the kinds of users who would stop the flow of misinformation, would report misinformation and disinformation. We were actually quite unusual in the methods we employed in this study, because we decided we were going to do a fully qualitative study with qualitative textual analysis of messages passing on WhatsApp. And the context of this was that since 2015, there had been more than 100 instances of people lynched to death in public very, very quickly, within 20 minutes to 30 minutes of WhatsApp messages spreading. And there were two types of WhatsApp messages that we began to see in that time. The first type of WhatsApp message was very localized, and it would be in a local language, and yet it followed a particular type of misinformation which came from around the world. It said the following thing. It said, a kidney snatcher, a child snatcher is coming to take your child. Watch out for strangers in your area. Pass on this message. And this led to the death of more than 40 people. There was a different type of misinformation which was circulating and which was very deliberate, so we can call it disinformation, because it was put out by groups which were connected to the government, which were connected to the ruling BJP party. And this was misinformation around anything to do with cows. So it would say, a group of cow thieves has come in such and such an area, and then within 2 hours or 3 hours, certain men, particularly Muslim men or men from the Dalit community, would be lynched to death. These kinds of violent effects of WhatsApp misinformation were what drew us to ask the question, who is putting out this misinformation and who is benefiting from it? In what way are they benefiting from it? So we thought that we really ought to go and study this. One of our findings was that it was not people with low media literacy, as had been frequently thought, who were the passers on and the makers of misinformation and disinformation in India. It was highly tech-savvy, urban, generally men, and many of them were able to bypass most of the technical fixes that WhatsApp had put in place to try to limit the number of shares of misinformation posts. They did this through a number of very, very easily accessible technical plugins, which you can get in India, by using old versions of the app on different phones, by buying very, very cheap mobile phones and throwing them away when the number got banned. So they worked around things which would stop misinformation and disinformation. So you have a group of highly technically literate people, generally Hindu, generally men, generally middle class, making disinformation either on behalf of or because they ideologically support the Hindu far right, and posting this in ways which affect disproportionately minority communities in India. Since COVID came onto the scene in India, this has taken the form of some extremely aggressive linking of the Muslim community to COVID. And I can tell you a bit more about that if you're interested.
Absolutely. I mean, it is horrific, what you've been setting out, but absolutely, we'd like to hear more about that.
So just before lockdown in India happened, which occurred on the 24th of March with only 4 hours notice, several days before that, there had been a large gathering of international Muslims called Tablighi Jamaat in a part of Delhi, which is traditionally a Muslim ghetto area. This gathering had not broken lockdown. However, when lockdown occurred, very, very quickly, almost as if it was prepared already, numbers of WhatsApp groups, Facebook posts, Twitter messages, ShareChat, there are various other cross-platform apps in India like ShareIt and ShareChat, started putting out the story from all of these troll groups and Hindu trolls, Hindutva trolls, saying the following thing, that Tablighi Jamaat was carrying out a COVID war on Hindus, that they were attempting to spread through India and spread the virus, and that therefore Muslims should be boycotted, that they should be pushed out of places, and that their goods and their wares should not be bought. There's so much evidence that this was completely done in conjunction with and with the knowledge of the government. In fact, various BJP MLAs came out violently and aggressively threatening Muslims, saying that they would not buy things from Muslims. It was, in effect, a request for a public boycott of the goods sold by a particular community who are already a very, very poor community in India. This led to some extremely violent attacks against Muslims. They were accused of sneezing on fruit and food deliberately to spread coronavirus, all completely false. And it also led to very, very tragic stories, not just the beating and beating to death of men, but the turning away from hospitals of pregnant Muslim women, which resulted in the deaths of either the pregnant woman or the child as well. It was absolutely tragic consequences to this highly politicized use of COVID misinformation.
I mean, what you said out is extraordinary. I mean, we've talked here about the real-world impacts of disinformation and misinformation on people's behaviour. But you know, the arson attacks on a mobile phone mast are nothing compared to the situations that you've been describing. I mean, what sort of outcry is there in India about the use of WhatsApp in this way? And is there pressure on the government to do, or on Facebook to do something about this?
That's such a good question. In fact, there's an outcry every time the government tries to or pretends to do something about it, in the sense that since the government itself has generated many of the views, many of the values, and many of the groups which are spreading this misinformation, they can't and they don't have the moral authority to tell anyone to stop. And in fact, no senior politician to date in the government or from the ruling party has actually come out and said that these are lies, this is misinformation. That is is how shocking the situation is. Instead, we have a steady series of medical and scientific misinformation coming out of the government, which diverts attention from the hate speech, which is linked to corona. And so you have government ministers saying that if you drink cow urine, you'll be safe from coronavirus. So it's very, very similar, very parallel to the bleach comments. If you spray yourself with cow urine, if you drink certain types of Ayurvedic herbs, you will never get coronavirus. If you bang pots and pans, the virus will die. So those are the kinds of big responses from the government, which totally sidestep any of the misinformation going on WhatsApp. On the other hand, the government wants to crack down on people who are calling out the misinformation and has been doing so in a very targeted way. So just like sort of in a way, almost exactly, more than what happened to Emily Maitlis, every time a journalist calls out or speaks about this kind of misinformation and shows where it leads back to, that person is threatened. Their office is put under surveillance. Their household is surveilled. The police visits them. They have a court case and an FIR, a first information report registered against them with the police for misinformation. So we are living in a truly dystopian world in India.
I mean, I think it's shocking, the picture that you paint, and we could spend, you know, we can't do anywhere near justice to that in the time that we have here, but a whole series of podcasts I think should be committed to it. But just one question about WhatsApp in particular I wanted to ask as well. I mean, from what you said, it sounds like really not the technical changes that Facebook have made to WhatsApp haven't really helped in restricting the abuse of WhatsApp to spread disinformation in India.
I wouldn't say they haven't helped at all. That would be unfair. And I do think there is a group of technologically minded people at WhatsApp in the US who are concerned, who are really trying, who in some ways, while they're a very small group and they have no sense of how severe the problem is in India, are trying to tackle it. I think the issue is that it's not a problem that can be tackled simply technologically. There's a huge sociopolitical context to it. And as we tried to explain to them in the findings of our report and the recommendations, they need to understand that context. They have an absolutely tiny team in India. I doubt it's more than 10 people. And for a country of, you know, of however million, 400 million WhatsApp users they claim, this is completely inadequate. Even if people were to report misinformation and disinformation where there was a tragedy about to unfold, no one would be able to do anything about it in time to prevent the tragedy. So we suggested that they have a far, far more aggressive attitude towards hate speech and misinformation, that they didn't have to de-encrypt to do this, that all they had to do was check cross apps. What that would mean was checking to see phone numbers on WhatsApp, which were also spreading misinformation on known platforms that were not encrypted, such as Facebook, such as Twitter, such as ShareIt. So where you take someone's clear record of spreading misinformation and you use that to ban the number, you do not accept that number, and that would reduce significantly the hate speech that is circulating. So it isn't that they have failed completely, but what they're doing is just so inadequate given the huge and government supported infrastructure for disinformation that's there at the present.
Yeah. And how many different languages are being used in India, do you think, as part of on WhatsApp to spread disinformation?
Hundreds of dialects, more than 30 languages. We've found misinformation and disinformation in multiple languages. And in each one, it is tailored towards a slightly different demographic or group. So, for instance, the story about child kidnapping, when it was being circulated in the south of India in Telugu and in Tamil and in Malayali, what happened there was that it would be a group of people from the north are coming, or strangers from the north are coming. And similarly, when those stories were circulating in the west, so in Maharashtra and in the north, it would say that people from the south are coming. So there were very, very interesting slightly localized fixes to try and make the misinformation more immediate, more urgent. And that definitely led to the gathering of mobs and the lynching of completely innocent people.
Well, we have, listening in as well to this incredible story, we have our two regular guests, Charles Creel and John Quinlan, who will give us their updates now. Charles, a huge amount been going on in the last few days. What have you been focusing on?
Hi, Damien. Really, the big story this week, as has been shown already in the show, is disinformation on Twitter, but almost overlooked after all the events with Donald Trump and so on, have been a number of stories running on disinformation and the coronavirus crisis specifically. Several of these were triggered by a new study from Carnegie Mellon that says that as many as 60% of accounts on Twitter that are promoting misinformation related to coronavirus are bots. Researchers analyzed nearly 200 million tweets, that's since January, referring to coronavirus, and looked for specific markers that typically identify bots. They found more than 100 false narratives and conspiracy theories related to COVID-19 that are perpetrated, or rather perpetuated, by these bots. The accounts behind these tweets account for 82% of the top 50 most influential retweeters on Twitter. They also observe twice as much bot activity as they predicted around coronavirus based on previous natural disasters, crises, elections, and so on. And this finding really corroborates what we've talked about in the past, an earlier finding by the EU in March that Russian media have deployed a significant disinformation campaign against the West that worsens the impact of coronavirus and generates panic, sows distrust, makes people not trust their governments, and so on. And observers are mostly expressing surprise at the degree of bot and fake account activity, where normally you'll find that 10 to 20% of tweets around a controversy are bot-driven. In this case, the number's more like 60%, and they really shouldn't be surprised. Studies at Oxford Internet Institute have shown similar percentages of bot activity in Russian, directed at Russian-speaking enclaves in frontline European states, and in Ukrainian. I mean, Ukraine is really the hot lab for disinformation development. So for the average person on Twitter, how do you spot a bot or a professional troll? Well, to spot a bot, the first thing you should do is you should look at the account profile. And this is a good way of ensuring that the information you're looking at is reliable. And there's a few questions to ask yourself. Is there a profile picture? Because lots of bots just have eggs. Does the profile picture seem legitimate? Often a bot will have a long number in the at name. It'll be at Bob77789326 or something like that. Also, is the biography believable or suspicious? And one of my favorite bot accounts I've ever seen had a biography that says, "I'm General John Nicholson from Baltimore, Maryland, and presently in Kabul, Afghanistan. I'm searching for a life partner." That's, you can be pretty sure that a general would not be tweeting something like that. Another one is, does the account have very many followers? And this is really important because by these measures, you could say that most of Donald Trump's 80 million followers could be judged as fake accounts. And I had a quick look through his followers that show that most of what I looked at had less than 100 followers. Many didn't have profile pictures at all. They had very suspect bios. Most show all these signs of being fake. I'd guess about 95% of them. But then I wandered over and I looked at Barack Obama's account. He has 40 million followers, and I saw the very same thing. So the question is, why? The instinct is that you think, well, they want a lot of attention, and so they're hiring lots of bots and social media companies to inflate their numbers. And particularly with Trump, you'd think that. But what really happens is that bot farms, when they're manufacturing bots, which is why you get the long numbers at the end of the at names, often start the lives of bots by having them follow and retweet really popular Twitter accounts, hoping that they'll gain followers in the same way. There's a kind of survival of the fittest at work with bots before they're then converted to human-controlled troll accounts. And why are we bunching bots and pro-trolls together? Because trolls at agencies like the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg often use accounts that start as bots, and if they gain enough followers, they're then taken over by human trolls. And they tweet multiple times in a short period, copy-paste text from other tweets, and so on. So,
it's kind of
checking
like
out your information is important.
sorry to interrupt. It sounds like sort of Pinocchio wanting to be a real boy, isn't it? Sort of, if you're a good bot, then you can become a real person.
Yeah, it's absolutely the case. Or if you're a good boy, you'll get enough followers.
Do you know, Damien, it's interesting, and I should say that it's very important to distinguish between the various John Nicholsons. Some are more trustworthy than others. At Mr. John Nicholson, I find is especially trustworthy as an account. But I'm interested in this because a recent analysis showed that 5% of all Scottish Twitter activity is by bots or troll accounts. A significant number of them come from Russia, according to recent analysis. And they tend to try and stir up aggravation and fights about controversial political subjects such as independence. And I think a lot of people have wondered, why on earth would the Russians really want to stir up an argument about independence in Scotland? And of course, it's because they want to create uncertainty, just as south of the border, they want to create social divisions, because there's some other very interesting statistics which have come out. And I don't know if you've seen this. This is the link between attacks on phone masts and belief that 5G is responsible for coronavirus. And the most recent statistics that we had before us in the select committee from the phone companies is that there are 34, believe it or not, 34 incidents of arson, attempted arson, or other forms of sabotage on EE mobile sites, and 104 separate incidents of violent, intimidating, and threatening behaviour against staff since 3rd of April alone. And 60 specific items of content or accounts on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter which have incited or helped to facilitate these attacks. In the 21st century, people are really running towards phone masts or phone company employees and attacking them because they believe that bits of metal can give them a virus.
And they're being driven there by bots. You know, the Oxford Internet Institute came out with a study not too long ago that showed that political discourse online in Russia was completely dominated by bots.
Can I just come in there, Damien?
Yes, please do, yeah.
I have absolutely no desire to defend Russian bots, and I think they're obviously out there and they're doing their work. But I think if we focus entirely on that, then I think we also take away a certain amount of agency from our own populations, and with agency comes responsibility. And I think we have plenty of homegrown bots. We have plenty of homegrown trolls. We know that people are employed by parties to put out misinformation and disinformation and ads which would count as misinformation and disinformation around things like Brexit on Twitter, on Facebook, to target people. We know this, and I know this from India. There's literally nobody else that can be blamed for the Indian misinformation going around except Indians. And so my instinct is to say, yes, of course, let's find the bots, let's find who's propelling them. Let's look at Russia and see what reason it might have to try and foment disenchantment and disenfranchisement in Western countries. But also, please, let's look at the people who are pushing disinformation agendas, far-right agendas, populist agendas within Europe, within the US, within Brazil, and across the rest of the world that counts itself as democratic, but can have very, very undemocratic processes taking place. And let's also put the blame fairly where it belongs, which gives us some sense that we can do something about it.
No, I think it's a really important point. And we discussed on a recent podcast with Tristan Harris at the in San Francisco that he described it as being like a sort of disinformation is like a kind of mimetic virus. And therefore, it's, you know, if that virus is spread at times by bots, the impact could be that it infects real people as well. You know, and indeed, that would demonstrate that the campaign is being successful because real people then take on and share that information too.
Absolutely.
But John Quinlan, you've been listening intently to all we've been discussing, as well as following everything that's been going on at Infotagen in the last few days. What's caught your eye recently?
Yeah, Damien. It's actually, I guess it's linked to everything that everyone's been saying. Actually, there's probably themes that we see every day. One of the things that I think we saw this week, which particularly caught our eye, it involves a few of the sort of buzzwords and themes that everyone else has already talked about. So the particular fact check that we got was that, is the US putting microchips in COVID-19 vaccines? And before I sort of talk about that for a second, just to say it's not true, but it came from a YouTube video that makes the claim based on inaccurate interpretation of an announcement that the DOD and HHS have awarded a vaccine contract to a company, but it includes nothing to do with microchips. I think that there has been some willful misinterpretation of what the company's history does, which sometimes includes RFID chips in the containers that include the vaccines, but not in the vaccines themselves. But if you were to look at the YouTube video and see some of the quotes there, there is some sort of buzzwords and things that we've heard a lot over the last few months. You know, things like, this is the global government. This is the mark of the beast. It's not just the vaccine, but it will put a chip in you and it will track you if you allow it. So obviously not true, and absolutely no sort of no worries on that score, but it is something that is being put out there, and you could conceivably see people being duped by it. So it's important to sort of fact check it and say that it's not true.
It's interesting. Look, I mean, from what you described, John, and thinking about what we've talked about in this podcast, how the sort of like psychology behind a lot of disinformation really feeds into quite ancient forms of paranoia, of sort of like, you know, beware of the stranger, beware of hidden powers being exercised around you that are manipulating society. And of course, our old friends, the Illuminati, that keep popping up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that something like the RFID chip, which is, you know, you can get that in sort of like clothes that just track, you know, so just a chip that allows a particular piece of clothing to be associated with a piece of technology and potentially whatever a brand or whatever wants to do with that. That's something that, you know, it's a sort of a very much more relatable version. But, you know, 5G, anything technological based, people seem to have latched onto. And put that with Corona or put that with a vaccine, it seems to hit the spot of what people are afraid of. And it's something that we're seeing continual mutations of every time we do a fact check, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been a brilliant discussion, and we've covered a huge amount of ground. And particularly fascinating to hear more in more detail about disinformation in India and the tragic consequences of that. So I think we're probably run out of time now. So thank you all very much. It's been great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Damien.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring John Nicholson, Sakuntala Banerjee, Charles Creel, and John Quinlan. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.